As a family physician for many years, it has been an interesting experience to see how access to healthcare has changed. When I have patients who come in who tell me that they now have health insurance after many years of not having had health insurance, it's a good thing. It makes me happy. So today we speak with two individuals who are going to help us understand why it is that we now are able to give patients access to healthcare when we weren't before, and also what that process entails and why it's important. Today we have with us Dr. Noah Nesson, who is the Chief Medical Officer for Penobscot Community Healthcare, which serves approximately 60,000 patients for their primary medical, behavioral health, and dental care needs. We also have with us Lisa Lemieux, who is a licensed social worker and the patient outreach and enrollment specialist at all three Daniel Frank David Russell Medical Center facilities. Lisa is a certified application counselor who works with both patients and community members to educate and assist them in knowing the options available to them through the Affordable Care Act. Thank you so much for coming in.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So this is an interesting topic, as I mentioned, for me, because as a family doctor, I've cared for patients kind of across the spectrum. I've cared for patients who are in jail and patients who are students in college and patients who are living in suburban, urban, and rural Maine. I've seen a lot of different people coming through my doors. And the one thing that kind of unites all of them is the need for basic healthcare services. And this is something that you both have quite a lot of experience with.
Yes, there's no question. I grew up in a household in rural Maine where my dad was the doctor for the community and sort of the old style family doctor mode, and saw that model. And in my own career as a family doctor like you, I tried to mimic that the best I could, although as medicine became more sophisticated with more resources, more tests, more and more I bumped into the barriers of the finances of people who were uninsured and couldn't afford some of the care that they needed or delayed or deferred their care because of the cost. So it is very gratifying to have more people covered and able to access care.
Right, and my role has been, it's a fairly new role here, as in many states, is to educate consumers about what their options are. So for the first time, people are really understanding what the healthcare can offer them, what plan is best for them, and know there's no pressure, there's no, you know, pressure to choose a plan. It's up to them. And so that's my role, is to guide them through that.
When we think about healthcare, often we think about things like vaccinations and preventive care. But what I find fascinating is that that you're also talking about behavioral health care and the work that you do and dental care. And you're also using the word client as opposed to patient. You're actually talking about somebody who has a choice, who's making a decision to access services.
Well, one of the catchphrases in healthcare these days is population health, and I've heard a number of definitions of population health, some of which I understand and some of which I don't. But fundamentally, it's about the wellness of the community in which we live, and we can think of community in a number of ways, but I think that's much more tangible for people. And really, that kind of integrated model and the patient or consumer or client as a partner in that model is really the best way to approach that. And until people have the kind of coverage that allows them to participate in that model, they're sort of outsiders or intermittent users of the system and therefore can't fully partner with us.
Now, Lisa, as a social worker, I suspect you've spent some time with individuals who maybe have financial difficulties, who maybe have problems emotionally. How does healthcare become more important for people who maybe are dealing with issues of unemployment or poverty or grief or loss?
I think that the interesting factor about this position is when health centers look to hire people to talk to consumers about health insurance, they didn't look for people that had health insurance experience, sales experience. The goal was to get people in who could just sit down and have a conversation and really understand where a person, where they were coming from, what their needs were, and how they were best going to be served. And so that helped us go through the different plans to talk to somebody and say, you know, what are your needs? And let's find something that can meet those needs. Financial issues play a big part in this Affordable Care Act. Here in Maine, you know, you need to be between 100 and 400% of the federal poverty level in order to qualify for a subsidy, and it's those subsidies that help define affordability. But, you know, there's two things I always say to people is, you know, affordable means different things to different people, and it's about their own health needs. And that's the two bottom, you know, lines that we're going to look at when we look at the plans for them.
So if I'm listening to the show and maybe say I'm an entrepreneur and I'm working on a startup, or I'm an artist perhaps, define for me what that looks like financially. You said 100 and 400% of the federal poverty level.
So for a household of one, I usually tell people it's like $11,600 is what you need to claim on your federal income taxes. So in Maine, it's a little difficult. One of the whole things is that you have to project your income for 2014. So people in January were going, I don't know what I'm going to make in 2014. You know, here in Maine, we have a lot of self-employed people. We have a lot of seasonal, part-time. So, you know, it's helping them figure out what their bottom line is going to be and changing it during the year if we need to, because that's what their subsidy is based on. So, yeah. So for, a person of one, it'd be like $11,600 is what I kind of say.
So that's not a lot of money.
It's not a lot of money. That's 100, the 100%, right?
Okay, so you can make between that amount and four times that amount.
Exactly.
Which is still not a lot of money, really.
Right.
So if you're one of the individuals who qualifies in that range, what can you expect to pay for health insurance?
Well, if you're right at that 100%, the majority of people I saw were paying $3 to $5 right at that 100%, and the higher up you go in income. It's based on your income and how many are in your household and where you live. And, you know, it's broken down into four districts here in Maine.
And age also.
And age, yes, thank you. Yeah.
So a young person who's single, the only member of the household, and low income could get a very significant subsidy, pay very little for insurance. Whereas a couple who has a combined income that's at the upper levels of that, who might be a little bit older, would pay a little bit more. And one of the phenomena that I have experienced in this is people who haven't accessed the insurance market previously, it takes a little bit for them to understand the value of that purchase, because it's still a fair amount of money if you're closer to the 400%, and knowing what that is relative to what they'd pay if they were in the private insurance market as opposed to the marketplace, is helpful in aiding people in understanding the value of what they're getting in that subsidy.
And I think that's an important point. If you're somebody who goes from never having had health insurance, never having paid for health insurance, to being faced with a bill that's $300 a month, that's going to seem pretty significant. Mm-hmm. However, when I was in private practice and I was paying for my own health and dental insurance, I think that at one point I was paying, you know, $500 to $600 a month, which is not insignificant.
And so, probably with a high deductible as part of that. And the nice thing about the marketplace plans is they can be very affordable for what's called a silver plan, which essentially means that 80% of the costs of health care in a year would be covered by the plan, which is quite a significant benefit.
One of the things that I'm interested in is how it has felt for you, Dr. Nesson, to see this all evolve. I believe when I was listening to a talk that you gave to a group of primary care doctors, you were talking about your father's office and how it was in your house, and you would watch patients come in and patients leave, and you'd talk about impacted tooths and, you know, crying babies, and it was a very personal, very family and community oriented type of practice.
Yes.
And what is this? It seems like we have gotten more into a numbers game than we ever have, which is good. And it's also different. and maybe not as intimate feeling as it once did.
It is. I always refer to my dad as a one-man patient-centered medical home because he was available 24 hours a day and provided, in those days in that model, integrated care because he was the only provider in town of any variety. So he did a little bit of dental care. He did a lot of behavioral health and lots of primary care. And so changes in the model are good. You know, people like him and those of his generation are rare these days. Most of us don't want to commit to that kind of availability around the clock every day of the year. And there's a price to pay for families and for the doctors themselves or providers themselves if they're working that hard all of the time. On the other hand, there's some depersonalization that occurs with that. And so our job in training medical students and healthcare providers and in building systems ought to be to identify people who can maintain compassion while working in a system that's quite different from the model of 50 years ago or even from early in my career in the late 1980s. And access all of the value in the current system, the ability to use data to manage population health, the technology that when used judiciously really can help improve people's lives, and yet maintain the kind of personal contact that is so fundamental to that provider-patient relationship, to that dynamic that helps people, helps motivate people, helps educate people, and helps them move always toward more wellness in their lives and in our communities. And part of our challenge in healthcare has been we've continued to recruit healthcare providers in the old model. You're younger than I am, so I'm sure you don't fit this mold, but I was recruited for the same reason. I was admitted to medical school for the same reason lots of people were, sort of self-starter, little bit sort of less sociable than other people, you know, sort of head in the books, type A driven, and that isn't necessarily the model we need for the future of healthcare. And we have to be more intentional about that, I think, to maintain what everybody wants in their experiences with healthcare.
Lisa, I think it's interesting that we are now at a place that's people who in the social work field have arguably been in for generations, the need to marry sort of logistical concerns and priorities with emotional and social concerns and priorities. And this is something that people who are social workers know. You know that you have to help somebody feed their children as well as help them deal with the loss of a parent. Right. And that's a broad range of things, but it's all part of the hierarchy of needs.
It is, absolutely. And I think that was one of the reasons for hiring us to talk to people. And again, you know, the first thing I say to somebody when I meet with them is, you know, I'm just here to show you what your options are. You know, I've had people not even choose a plan because of that, you know, what we thought was going to be affordable really isn't affordable when we're looking at them trying to put food on their table. And then we look for other alternatives for them. But it's all about education and understanding what their choices are. And I think for the first time, people are understanding the different plans that are available to them and what the consequence is if they choose not to take the plan at this time, because there will be a financial penalty for some people, and for others we can certainly do a hardship waiver. So it's all, again, it's tied into education and trying to meet their needs and what feels good to them.
And I think also for the previously uninsured, I'd be interested to know if this is your experience as well, but I hear people a lot talking about the cost of whatever their share of their premium is compared to no cost, as opposed to comparing that to the cost of having a healthcare need unmet or having to pay for an emergency healthcare need. And that's a discussion I've had with lots of friends and family who are interested in this but mm-hmm. wonder if there's value in it.
I think that's sometimes a cultural mm-hmm. thing of growing up, maybe people that have never had insurance. It's that education piece about what is now offered to you. And I do think the word is getting out. You know, people, I think last year I certainly had people say, well, I'm going to wait and see, because there was a lot of let's wait and see how this goes.
Especially with the way the marketplace rolled out last
really
fall.
It really was.
People hesitate.
Yeah. And a lot of people like, is this going to work? There's no guarantees with anything. So some people really kind of stepped back and they kind of waited. But I think they're talking to people that took that bold step and said, sign me up. And I'm sure you've probably had the same. And you've also said you've met with patients who are really excited to have health insurance. And I think the exciting thing is that they understand it and what they can get for that health insurance as well. So really meeting the need of education.
I also think that there is a sense of fear associated with not having health insurance, because it's all fine when you're healthy. When you didn't break a leg, or your child didn't have appendicitis, or you haven't had a diagnosis of cancer, if you can stay healthy and you can avoid all accidents, then that's great. But we know that one of the major problems associated with financial struggle is medical debt. And this is becoming increasingly challenging because our costs are much higher than they used to be.
People lose homes, people become homeless, people, families break up over some of the financial stresses that are caused by medical debt, and they can be devastating. And as you know, there was a Time Magazine article in the last year, I think, that sort of detailed some of the variabilities in costs from facility to facility and state to state, and things that one might not think would cost a tremendous amount, like a simple appendectomy or hip replacement, which are not cheap, but the cost variability is so dramatic that without health insurance and with the requirement that you pay that, it could end your ability to retire, for instance, at a minimum, or make it impossible for you to pay your mortgage or pay off your car payment.
I think that's one of the things with this new marketplace plans, is that there's actually an out-of-pocket cap on all of them, and that was really appealing to a lot of people. $6,500, you're covered at 100% after that. So you talk to somebody and you say, you know, what happens if you're in the hospital for 2, 3, 4 days? That debt is, you know, accumulating. But once you hit that out-of-pocket, and it can actually be actually lower than that depending on your subsidy and your cost-sharing reductions, the 100% federal poverty level, typically their out-of-pocket maximum is $500. And then they're covered at 100% for the rest of the year after that. So those are big pieces to talk to people about.
I've also seen in my practice that people will actually verbalize. They will say, well, Dr. Belial, I know that I need to keep myself healthier because it will cost me more if I don't. And this is something that is relatively new, that people are actually understanding that if they can't lose the weight that they've gained, or if they don't take care of their diet, then, you know, they'll have problems, say, for joint pain because they've become obese, or heart attacks because they can't control their cholesterol levels. And they're now knowing that there's something I can do about this. Like, I can take some control over my life so that whatever I can control, I can control, and whatever I can't, it will be covered by insurance, which is, I think, really great. It's really nice to know that people are that engaged.
I do think there's an increasing level of sophistication both among patients and providers about exactly that kind of engagement, and certainly among purchasers, especially employers who pay for health insurance for their employees, that you see more and more wellness programs, but not just more wellness programs, more involved wellness programs that really do promote health and in important ways, and they're constantly refining them. In addition, some of the payers, like Maine Community Health Options, one of the marketplace plans, really has been pioneering value-based benefits, which really do get at trying to motivate people to do the things for themselves that will keep them in better health and therefore limit their cost, the cost of the insurer, the cost of the employer, the cost of the entire healthcare system. Because, as you know, we're in a system that spends 40% of the world's healthcare dollars on 5% of the world's population and has something like the 35th or 36th best outcomes. So we don't have an efficient system right now, and part of what's been missing is exactly that kind of engagement that you just spoke about.
As I'm thinking about what the healthcare educational system and recruiting system has been, and you were describing, you know, type A personalities, medical students who were able to put their noses to the grindstone and just kind of plow through all the work. And that really was, I believe, your father's practice model.
Yes.
And I think there are still medical students who go in with that idea in mind. But what I'm understanding is that this, the ability to be collaborative is so much more critical. And in fact, as a physician, I feel better because I now know that there are people with me who can offer some of the things that traditionally I had been asked to do all by myself. You know, there are people who can help me in the areas of behavioral health and dental health. And my team in Brunswick, the nurses do so much more because they're able to do so much more. So I love working as a team because it makes my job actually much easier.
It is easier, and we know it's better care, that the more delegation that goes on within the care team, the better the outcomes for the patients that we serve. And you're exactly right. That transformation from it relies on my memory, my good intentions, my knowledge base, and my energy on a day-to-day basis, and my need to control everything that goes on with the people that I serve, to my team's commitment to this, how elegant the delegation model is, how well people understand their roles and the parameters of their roles, the amount of autonomy within in that team for people to act in ways that serve the patients best, and all of that supported by the kind of data that helps us adjust our work system so that we really are providing care as efficiently and as effectively as we can to people. And that is a different mindset for those of us who were trained in the control freak model, to be a collaborator, a team leader, to delegate responsibility, and to accept responsibility for that team's performance.
Lisa, do you have any final thoughts for people who are in the marketplace now and who are looking for options that are available to them through the Affordable Care Act?
Well, open enrollment starts November 15th, and people have from November 15th to February 15th to shop for a plan and purchase a plan. And then after that, it closes, except for special enrollment situations like having a baby, getting married, moving, something like that. So there's a 3-month window that I say to people, it just doesn't hurt to see what your options are. Give any certified application counselor or navigator, you can find them listed on Enroll 207 and find one in your area, and they'd be happy to go over some plans with you. And at least you know what your options are, what your choices are, and then you can make an informed decision. So it doesn't cost anything.
And how about you, Dr. Nesson? Do you have any final thoughts?
I do. Just that I'm so pleased to be able to work in a community health center the way that Lisa does. Mm-hmm. This kind of partnership, this kind of team approach that you described, is fundamental to what we do, and the commitment to serve all of the population of Maine, regardless of their ability to pay. And I hope that we'll be able to, at some point, expand Maine care, because there's a big population that the marketplace doesn't serve. And that's exactly what the expansion of MainCare was designed to address. So hopefully someday we'll get to that so that we really can reach all people in Maine.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is a laudable goal, and I'm going to put my energy behind that intention as well.
Right.
We've been speaking with Dr. Noah Nesson, the Chief Medical Officer for the Penobscot Community Healthcare System, and also Lisa Lemieux, a licensed social worker and patient outreach and enrollment specialist with the Daniel Frank David Russell Medical Center facilities. Thanks so much for coming in and talking to us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.